Hey, everyone. This is Transistor Radio, where we do a chip chat. And I'm Doug. And this is Dylan.
Hey, folks.
Yeah. So we haven't done one of these in a while. We've been a little bit falling behind the schedule. But this time, we actually have a lot of good conversation to have. There's been a lot of exciting new things. And I think today we really want to cover about backside power delivery network and CXL, two important transformations that are coming in the data center and chips. And yeah, we just want to give you the lowdown, what it is, why it matters, and maybe, you know, why this will change the industry going forward. So first, I'm just going to ask Dylan, because he's the technical master, what is a backside power delivery network?
Sure. So for all of the history of chips, we've had power and signal come in from one side of the chip. Signal and power, at least routing, right? So, you know, your transistors, they're on one side, it's called the front side. And then you have the metal layers go up from there, and your signals are sent through that metal layer, but also your power is. So you can see how problematic that is if you think about, oh, wow, I have a bunch of power interfering with my signals, right? My ones and zeros are just clogged up by some other stuff. And in the most simple terms, right? And so what backside power delivery network does is it completely splits that out, right? Your signal is still on the same side, but once you're done processing all the layers that route signals, you flip the wafer over and you build up where the power comes in from. And that creates a real transformation, right? You have much better power delivery to the cells. You have much better signal integrity on the signal side, and you can optimize each side of the stack for its specific work, you know, use case. And then it also is a huge benefit in transistor scaling. And so this is something that's going to really change the industry going forward. And it's arguably as big of a shift as the first EUV nodes, you know, in terms of scaling impact. So big, big, big way that Moore's Law will be kept alive, if you will.
Yeah, it's really interesting. It's kind of essentially another leg of the specialization we're starting to see in semiconductors. I really didn't appreciate how simple it was to scale in the past. So I believe they're starting to call this design technology co-optimization, right? DTCO. And DTCO is just how we specialize in scale transistors using more intelligent logic whenever we make it. So back in the day when we were making a planar chip, we literally just shrank it, smaller dimensions, same cell library, same logic every single year. It was hard to shrink it every single year, but now going forward from planar to FinFET to gate-all-around to now design technology, now to backside power delivery network, these are all design technology co-optimization, meaning just ways that we're actually thinking about how to make the chip in a more intelligent manner. And so this, especially on the power network aspect of it, is going to be a huge game changer, because chips, one of the biggest constraints is power, right? The power drop makes them less efficient. And also there is kind of this like broken scaling law with how much power you can put into the cores and giving you performance in return. So all of these things together are going to be arguably the next leg post EUV scaling and gate all around. And I would not be surprised if after that we think of something even more clever. There's always going to be another way to design the chip more clever. But obviously, backside power delivery network is the first wave that we're really starting to see. And it's kind of a continuation of advanced packaging, right? We want to talk about like how that's going to happen. I've been really confused if it's going to be like a flip chip or hybrid bonding, but like the technical side, I'm sure Dylan, you're on top of this, right?
Yeah. So I don't follow your question. Sorry.
Yeah. Well, I mean like how, okay. So let's talk about how, you know, you split the power and signal into two different layers and then you put the chip together. How is that exactly going to like happen? And I mean, that is an advanced packaging technology, right? This is just a continuation of what we've already seen in advanced packaging. Yeah. Yeah. Okay. Just would love
to
hear you.
So with chips right now, right? You process the transistors, and then you once you're done processing the transistor, then you build, you know, a dozen metal layers or so that are just connecting them all up. And at the very top of the metal layers, then you have your pinout, right? And if it's advanced packaging, you know, they're, you know, 50 micron, 10 micron apart, each point of input and output. But if you're talking about traditional, then you're talking 300, 500, et cetera. So when you do backside power delivery network, you know, this kind of flips on its head in terms of your signal is now on the opposite side as well, like where you're inputting and outputting data. So yes, your signal routing is separated onto the same side of the wafer as it was before, but you're not also inputting signal from that side, right? You're inputting signal from the same side that you take power from. It's just the transistors aren't talking to each other from that side. Does that sort of make sense? So, you know, in terms of packaging, it's really, you know, almost agnostic for most packaging types, unless you're talking about hybrid bonding, in which case there is some considerations when you move to backside power delivery network. But for, you know, a flip chip or, you know, a 2.5D or anything like that, that's all going to be about the same.
Okay, cool. No, I think I was supposed to say, like, on the wafer on wafer aspect of it, right? There's a big change there, right? Who makes the tools for that? Do you know? Because
Yeah. So there's what they do is once they build up the, you know, build the transistors, build the signals, they bond a wafer to that side and then they flip it over and then they process everything up. And the reason they do that is because the wafer is really thin and they need something to basically, you know, carry it around. They need some structural integrity, et cetera, et cetera. So that they grind it down and then they build up the power side. And when they do that, they are using, you know, a couple different tools, right? You have to use a lot of polishing of the wafer to make it ultra thin. So that's going to be mostly applied materials. But then you're having to do wafer on wafer bonding. And so the leaders in wafer on wafer bonding are EV Group, which is a private company out of Europe, and Tokyo Electron, which is in, Japan, obviously. So those are the two leaders in wafer on wafer bonding. Applied Materials likes to talk about how they are really big in bonding as well, but their sort of stronghold is that they're in every step around the actual bonding process. They're not actually in the bonding process, which is an interesting way to look at it, right? They have the most revenue, you know, growth from hybrid bonding, despite not doing anything to do, having nothing to do with bonding itself.
Okay, cool. That's a really good, would love the clarity because I've been kind of following this space, but I'm like very confused about the exact vendors, so that's perfect. So all these things together, backside power delivery network, clearly this huge new growth vector of like tools, complexity and scaling. And this is like, you know, this is day zero, I guess. And where this starts to intersect with the chip timelines and roadmaps of the future is probably like 2024, right? PowerVia is supposedly in the 28 process for Intel. And then also on the TSMC side, we've heard rumors of the buried powered rail, which is one way to do this backside power, or I guess a permutation of a new power delivery method. But do we know when TSMC inserts this into their node process or no?
Yeah, so there's actually some confusion around that, but then they cleared it up literally today. So, you know, they have their technology symposium. They did it in North America, and a lot of the media came out saying, oh, it's on 2 nanometer. It's on TSMC's 2 nanometer gate all around. So, you know, about 2025, 2026, but, you know, they did their same exact symposium in Europe and the media from there came out saying, oh, it's not on the original one. It's not in the initial 2 nanometer. It's on a future evolution, right? So TSMC, you know, being cautious as they always are, they want to implement, you know, ribbon FET gate all around, you know, transistors first. And then once they do that, they want to transition, you know, in a later evolution of that node to bring about the backside power delivery network. And whether it's buried power rail or not, I don't think they're going to do buried power rail on 2 nanometer. It doesn't give you as much benefit in scaling, right? So that would be a big drawback if they only do buried power rail, which buried power rail still has the signal and power delivery on the same side. It's just there is a rail on the other side of the transistors it's a little complicated. You'd need an image to really look at it, but
yeah, it's like a hybrid method, right? Like it's like, I know it splits some of the power away, but not all of it. So it's essentially just like a kind of like a gap technology, but the appeal of buried powered rail is probably that we could do it right now with today's tools. I don't think there is a lot of research to get from today to buried powered rail. So maybe this could happen in like a energy efficient node, half node or something in the future, but it's maybe unlikely versus the PowerVia. And so then we look on the Intel side, it makes a lot of sense now finally, because like I used to get asked this question all the time and I'm like, I have no idea how Intel is going to come back and take the process lead or whatever. It's like, now I finally get it. Intel is betting the farm and doing both of them at once. And that's like the big risk. So if they do it both at once, and then they have this huge shrink difference, a huge power difference, then they are the best node, and they get to leapfrog back in the lead. So like, you know, this is clearly a huge important thing, kind of like how EV inserted for TSMC first. So this is how they get the snapback, but their ability to actually execute on it is like a whole different story, right? And we'll see about that.
All that is, you know, yeah, everybody's worried, you know, hey, Intel's going to try to do both of these at once. It's kind of dangerous, right? You know, the whole reason 10 nanometers sucked is because they tried to do everything at once, right? You know, new materials, you know, a lot of multi-patterning without EUV, you know, all sorts of things, you know, self-aligned gate contacts, all sorts of things that, you know, Intel stuffed in 10 nanometer all at once that, you know, companies like TSMC spent multiple node transitions doing. You know, to de-risk it, you know, it's a scary thing. But what Intel's in a whole line is that, hey, we're actually building an internal only node. So it's going to be their 3 nanometer, but they're going to do PowerV on it. And they're just going to build a couple of chips for internal test purposes. That way they kind of have it debugged separately. And that's sort of their whole mantra of their process development now. It's called process modules, right? You know, they're going to implement those separately on various different nodes. So for example, their 4 nanometer is very similar to their 3 nanometer, except it's only the high performance process modules. There's nothing to do with high density, right? You know, it de-risks a lot of things. And then 3 nanometer brings all of those, you know, in, you know, the 4 nanometer node can't even do IO, right? It has to be done in a chiplet manner with advanced packaging. There's literally no way it can do IO because they just said, you know what, let's keep everything simple. Let's only focus on one thing for this process node. And then they bring it all to 3. And then in the same kind of vein, they're doing a sort of internal node that does only backside power delivery network with an existing 3 nanometer node in-house before they ever try to do 20A, which brings about, you know, gate all around and backside power delivery network. So that's their whole tagline on, hey, this isn't going to, you know, burn us in terms of we're going to be cautious. We're going to develop things separately, but we'll see how that turns out. You know, I'm cautiously optimistic.
Me too. That's how I feel. Like everything you're saying sounds really great, right? You're like, okay, they're going to split all the different process controls into different nodes. They're going to do half internal nodes. It's going to be all this stuff. And then in the end, they'll magically put it all together and boom, perfect node. But like, you know, show me the execution, baby. Like this has happened, or, you know, the arrogance in the past has happened. And obviously they're a lot more conservative and all, and cautious about this, but clearly it's a big task, a very huge task. And if they succeed, I could see how it works very quickly, but you know, there's a lot of, we'll have a lot of interesting steps along the way to get us there. Right. So whenever we have the high performance,
And small steps doesn't, you know, work always, right? Cause you could look at Samsung's nodes, right. And they take more small steps than TSMC, but all their nodes suck. Right. So, you know, that's on the foundry side. So it's like, no, you can't just take small steps and ta-da, it works. There's a lot more here.
Yeah, making a chip is pretty complex. It's a lot. Yeah, there's so many parts in the process. So, okay, so we talked about backside power delivery. I kind of wanted to shift to obviously like kind of a whole other thing, because I guess it's a technical episode more than like a news episode. I kind of want to talk about CXL because I've been going deep down the rabbit hole on that one. I was actually on a podcast recently, yet another value blogger. I was talking about CXL from like a very high level perspective, but I'm just like trying to really break it to like how important and how transformative this really is. Like it's going to change the data center architecture in this huge way that people just like do not appreciate at all. Like we've been doing it it actually reminds me of the M1. Like that's my favorite analogy right now, is that essentially it's going to have a specialization in all the like racks so that it could create a better optimized and heterogeneous solution, and the performance, power, whatever benefits at scale is going to be some kind of similar huge step change forward that is like relatively revolutionary. Would you agree, disagree on that statement?
Yeah, it's definitely about bringing, you know, heterogeneity to the data center, right? And it's, you know, CPU is king, but guess what? You know, CPU is bad at a lot of stuff. And with Moore's Law, very slow, especially on the cost scaling side, right? You know, what are you going to do to increase your performance? Well, obviously you're going to add specialized silicon. Okay. But how does that specialized silicon hook into the entire network? Right. And that's the problem, is, you know, with the standard that we've been using for decades, which is PCIe, it doesn't hook in well, right? You know, you're duplicating memory across, you know, all over the place. You're spending a lot of money on, you know, on that memory, right? Which is one of the core issues with you know, that. And then the other thing is, you know, when you want to talk to each other, you have to go through a bunch of basically, you know, think hula hoops, right? You have to jump through these hula hoops that are on fire. And that slows down your ability to talk to each other, right? Between these various heterogeneous processors. And CXL at its core is about breaking all of that down. I love the M1 analogy because it's like, yeah, why is M1 awesome? Well, it's not really because their CPU is great, which it is. It's pretty good. You know, it doesn't perform better, but it's more efficient. But what really makes it awesome is that everything is tied together, right? You know, every single different kind of IP block for accelerating different stuff, right? The M1 is the best laptop for, you know, M1 and M2 stuff is the best laptop for video editing and creative workflows and this and that. And it's not because just the CPU, right? Or the GPU kicks ass. It's because everything works together. They're media blocks. Everything works together in an amazing way. And it's completely, you know, shares the same memory pool. So in that sense, right, CXL will do that for the data center.
Yeah. Yeah. What's really cool is that I didn't really realize this, but like, you know, GPU nodes in particular are very like almost sheltered off in their own. GPU has like a lot of on memory or memory on the GPU. And something that's really interesting is like, it's going to be really crazy to watch these accelerators be unleashed essentially, because there is probably some kind of bottleneck for GPUs in large models. So you could definitely imagine the data center of the future having, you know, an H100 pod where there's like, you know, 10, whatever, 40 GPUs, but it's just like attached to like an unfathomable amount of memory. And that like really breaks that bottleneck open. And so there's so many ways that this is going to play out. Like I was actually talking to someone about this and they're talking about like a good example is whenever a transaction fails because of a server crash, you could actually, that won't fail because the transaction will still be in memory. So like, there'll be more redundancy in the data center. There'll be more like, there'll be more resilience. There'll be more scalability. There's so many aspects of this that are like legitimately game-changing and revolutionary, but we just don't see it yet because, and something I'm also really interested in is CXL will be able to enable new revenue streams from the hyperscalers that didn't exist before because it's legitimately a new technology. It legitimately will have like new flexible use cases. And we're not just talking about like a CPU with, you know, elastic DRAM capacity. We're talking about like, oh, you know, a hybrid custom stack for a solution at hand. That's what I'm really excited about for the long term, like let's say the 2030 dream team. So do you want to talk about like the specifics of CXL and how it works or like, cause I feel like explaining at least what cache coherency means is probably really helpful because it's a complicated idea because right now the data center is kind of just like these thousand little nodes connected together versus cache coherency. Do you want to talk about that?
Sure. So at its core, right, you know, when you put memory at different places, you can either, you know, think about like the post office trying to talk to each other, right? If you're sending mail with each other, by the time you send the mail to someone, right, to one post office, you know, things might have changed already. And so you have to lock stuff down and not be able to work on it at all, right? If you're trying to sort of communicate with each other. What cache coherency does is it sort of makes everything more uniform and more coherent between each other, right? The word coherent. And so you might cache a copy of the data that's on another server. You might continually update both of them, or you might never even keep that data on your own processor, right? You might only keep it in that remote location where everyone manages that same pool of memory. And that pool of memory is up to, you know, think like a web server, right? If I access it from where I'm at, or if Doug accesses it from where he's at, you know, it's the same, right? And so that's sort of what the beauty of cache coherency is. And there's no, you know, long handshake of making sure, oh, hey, was Doug playing with that piece of memory? Oh, well, then I can't use it right now, right? There's none of that going on. We both can look at it and see what's there.
Yeah,
I think that's the simplest way to explain it.
Yeah, I think that's a pretty good way to explain it. I mean, like, and it's really hard to, like, think about how, because, you know, computers are really fast, but like think about how big these a good example is like an AI model, right? You're constantly changing all the variables and weights. And let's say you're trying to change the entire model and like, you know, do an entire trend and it's waiting for one piece of the puzzle versus if you had all the memory and you could change it all the time and check in, check out, it would be a lot quicker. And so there's just so many ways that this is going to progress so many aspects of, you know, compute going forward. So we had this debate with someone with each other, plus other people hopped in about like, what do you think this does for DRAM in the long term in the data center? Because I think I was, I, I know what I think now, but I definitely thought it was really interesting because we disagreed. I think I flip-flopped, but I would love to hear your thoughts about how you think that impacts the DRAM players in the short term and the long run.
Yeah, so taking a step back, right? One of the most exciting things about CXL is that you can share memory across everywhere, right? Or you can extend your memory to larger pools. And why is that so important? Well, because memory is like half the cost of your servers now, of your CapEx. And that's incredibly expensive, right? You know, you talk about, Intel versus AMD CPU. Yeah, no one cares if AMD's is $2,000 more expensive or cheaper, right? It actually doesn't matter because you're buying 512 gigabytes of RAM and that costs an order magnitude than that difference, right? You know, it's irrelevant, right? And 512 gigabytes is sort of the baseline. There's a lot of servers that go way beyond that. So your processor choice doesn't actually matter as far as like the total cost of the system. It's DRAM, right? So, but then the issue is, okay, well, what if I have a workload that spans thousands of servers? Okay, well, I'm going to put, you know, memory in every single server and oh crap, you know, they talk to each other very slowly. So I'm going to put a lot of the stuff that I access frequently on all of them. Okay, well, now I'm wasting tons of money on putting stuff in memory everywhere. And that's very, very expensive, right? So what's the solution, right? The solution is that you pool the memory, right? You put the memory in one place and then everyone else can access it, you know, all at once. You know, systems will still have their own independent memory, but at the same time, they'll also have this pool of memory where they can access stuff, you know, maybe a little bit slower than their main memory, but definitely still very fast and very, you know, much cheaper, right? Because now you're not putting memory, as much memory everywhere. Maybe you can get away with, instead of 512 gigabytes, you can get away with 256 gigabytes in every CPU in the rack, in the server rack. And then in the whole server rack, you might have, you know, those just say 30 CPUs, and then they can all share one main pool of, you know, 2 terabytes of memory. Now your total DRAM has gone down, but you know, the actual effective amount of DRAM that you're using, you know, once you get away from the fact that you were holding that same data everywhere, is actually, you know, better. So that's a big advantage of CXL. You know, so that's the whole argument of like, hey, CXL is really bad for DRAM. The other side of the coin is actually very positive because right now servers can only, you know, scale to a certain memory size. And as you get to higher and higher capacities, each individual stick of DRAM gets exponentially more expensive. Those high density sticks are lower volume. It's more complex to put them together, et cetera, et cetera. So you end up with like, hey, a stick that's 256 gigabytes is not 8 times more expensive than one that's 32 gigabytes. It's like 50 times more expensive, right? And so the potentiality is that, hey, you know, if I want to have a server with 2 terabytes of memory, or 4 terabytes of memory, or 8 terabytes of memory, I can do that with CXL by just putting these little cards that have memory on them into the server. And so that's the whole, you know, hey, this is going to increase the amount of memory use.
So and in that case, what could happen is that the very high end ASP for DRAM and density for DRAM sticks, where presumably that they're making higher margins on, becomes a lot less important. And DRAM in the data center actually becomes a lot more commodity-like, actually, where in the short run, there maybe is like all this mix that, you know, because I'm going to guess in the very short run, CXL is probably going to increase DRAM because they're just going to be like, screw it, we're attaching DRAM to everything, right? They're just going to like, there's going to be DRAM memory pooled racks and everywhere. And then we're like, oh, we're going to figure out how to optimize this. And then over the longer term, they're going to be like, well, we can actually do cheaper, like effective cost per gigabyte of DRAM because we can use more commodity like sticks and we just make bigger and bigger elastic pools of compute. And then over time, they're going to figure out how to really just like really crank up the utilization and almost and kind of flip the DRAM intensity thesis on its head, because there's slides that Micron loves to put out, right? DRAM as a percentage of total data center spend has gone up only one way, obviously because DRAM is a huge bottleneck. And on top of that, DRAM is extremely expensive and there's stranded DRAM. But now I feel like this is one of the first tools we have to really move utilization higher up. Kind of like how the server CPU's utilization moved a lot higher up whenever we worked on virtualization and sharing, you know, multiple hosts in one server. So I think over a longer period of time, it will probably move utilization up at least. I mean, maybe it'll consume more memory, but I think it's probably maybe bad over the very long run. But in this intermediate period, which is probably like, I mean, CXL is a pretty long-term thing, right? 2023, 2024 is kind of when I think CXL 1.0 or 2.0 will start to be deployed, and we might be able to see memory pools, but I don't really think that we'll start to see them en masse until much later. So we have a lot longer until then, but I'm really interested how this will change the relationship with hyperscalers and DRAM customers. Because it's going to be there.
Yeah. So we talked a lot about, you know, memory, but, you know, let's talk a little bit about where, you know, CXL is and how it evolves, right? So the first one is really only about, hey, plug in this, you know, accelerator, and it has cache coherency with the CPU that it's attached to. So that's the real, real advantage of CXL one. And then the other one is, hey, you can just stick in these, you know, basically DRAM sticks into PCIe slots, right? And, you know, that's a simple way of looking at it, but, and you can expand your memory more, right? So CXL one is all totally, hey, you know, more DRAM. But that's only going to exist on, you know, the high end of servers, the very ultra high end of servers. And then CXL, you know, that is going to be, you know, the CPUs that include that will launch, you know, late this year or early next year from, you know, AMD and Intel, right? And then CXL two is, you know, even further away, right? That's, you know, you're talking about, you know, late 23 or maybe 24 for that. And that's where you can start to pool memory. But even then, it doesn't, you know, there's some limits on how far you can pool memory, because you can't switch the CXL standard quite properly with CXL 2.0, right? So switching, you know, think about how you have networking switches and on the top of every rack. Well, you know, it wouldn't be, you know, absurd to see CXL switches in every rack as well that connect every server to each other. And that's not really going to be possible with CXL 2.0 either. So you will see some memory pooling on CXL 2, but really it's even beyond that, right? When CXL 3 gets implemented in processors, who knows, probably like 24, 25. And that's really when I see the hockey stick for, you know, CXL adoption, at least on the DRAM side of things. On the accelerator side of things, I don't think it really changes things too much, especially given, you know, number one accelerator company is going to start trying to sell their CPUs and GPUs on one board. Yeah. Right.
And they have their own fabric.
Like, oh, well, screw you guys.
Yeah. They have their own fabric too. Like they already have a very defined version of the future. I agree. And then the other thing too is like, this is a topology change, right? Like imagine AWS changing their entire footprint overnight. No, it's going to take years for it to really change. But when that happens, it's going to be really interesting. So I'm still really amped about it. But yes, you're right on like pumping the brakes on the timeline. But I feel like being on top of this early is going to be really interesting, because another thing is we've only been talking about the data center level CXL, right? But CXL is actually going to probably be used as the protocol for UCIe, which seems to be the standard that people really want to use for these like universal chip interconnect consortium, right? Essentially, it's the point of it is to make the availability and a protocol so that chiplets can work with each other, even from different companies on a single package, and they don't have to like, you know, it doesn't have to all be from a single vendor. So it would really be a true heterogeneous future of being able to pick and place like your IP and your what semiconductors you want on your package altogether. But what's interesting is CXL is tightly integrated with that. So it's going to be strategic on the bottom level, and it's going to be strategic on the top level. But my favorite take actually is PCIe over the very long term is not long for this world, at least if there's no SIFO in it. Because
I mean, that's true, but everything, you know, it's built on top of it, right?
Yeah,
so, you know, it's cool. CXL is a protocol, but it's built entirely on top of PCIe, right? What is CXL 1 and 2? It's on top of PCIe 5. What is CXL 3? It's on top of PCIe 6, right? So it's like, sure, it's not long for the world, but
It's going to be a long for the world asterisk the next 5 to 10 years. So it's like this, like, I think the dream state is silicon photonics, right? Because in like really moving away from the PCIe standard.
Yeah.
But that's just so like, there's so much wood to chop before then. So that's like something I've been thinking a lot about, but obviously this is a little bit immature. We're a little early days still. So, but all these things together, I think are just like this huge sea change, and it's going to be this huge sea change for a decade probably. And I feel like we're just on the cusp of it. Like year zero is probably 2023 I guess year zero is now because CXL one, right? But like real CXL, like the CXL that where we start to have some memory pooling, I think that's 2023 is year zero.
Yeah, I mean, I, as far as I know, the next generation Intel and AMD chips only have 1.1 or whatever, 1.1, 1.2. So, and those are, you know, those launch end of year or early next year, right? You know, Intel, I think, delayed theirs again. So it's, theirs is early next year. But, you know, AMD is the end of this year. So yeah, that's like CXL1 when it launches, right? Because there is no CXL1 compatible chips in the market, yeah, as far as I know, right? NVIDIA's launched their Hopper GPU, but there's no PCIe 5 CPUs for them to stick them into, so they can't sell anything.
Yeah, no, right? it's weird.
It's like that kind of conundrum. So you know, you can maybe develop your own CXL devices, but there's nothing to plug it into until next year. And then CXL2 is even beyond that, right? So I think 2023 is probably this is year zero.
Well, what's really interesting is that CXL like 2 actually has like a little bit of a hybrid, because the 2.0 spec, essentially there's three types of CXL. There's the .io, .memory, .cache. I think the .io essentially is just built on PCIe 5. So like really it's going to be like PCIe 5 is going to end up being kind of a hybrid 1.5, like 1 to 2 generation at some point, where CXL.io is fully available, which is obviously cache coherency between the accelerator and CPU. And then we're going to start to see, you know, a pretty good version of CXL.io would be really awesome. And then obviously the addition, the evolution beyond that is really going to be exciting. So yeah, I would say 23 is year zero. So we have a lot of growth ahead of us, but I mean, it's going to be,
I want to expand on the UCIe point that you mentioned earlier, because that is one that I'm very excited about. Right. So when you think about UCIe, it's like, okay, well, chiplets, awesome. But UCIe is making it standardized so that you can take an Intel chiplet and stick it next to Google's TPU chiplet if they want to make one, right? Okay, big whoop. So it's a standardized protocol or standardized physical implementation. And then CXL is what they want the protocol to be, right? So Intel is saying, yeah, it's protocol agnostic, but we think it makes sense for everyone to just use CXL. Great. So everyone uses CXL over UCIe. And UCIe, the standard width of that is 64 lanes. So think an NVIDIA GPU connects to a CPU with 16 lanes. So you're talking about 4 times the bandwidth at minimum, you know, right? And then you're talking about going from PCIe 4 speeds to 5 speeds. So really, you're talking about an 8x of bandwidth. And so what is that going to mean, right? If you have a chiplet, well, you know, Google or, you know, Amazon or, you know, Facebook can say, hey, you know, whatever, we're going to build our own AI chiplet. And hey, Intel, AMD, can you just make a CPU that has UCIe, 64 lanes of it, and just a port for that, you know, 2 ports for it, 5 ports for it, whatever it is. And then, hey, can you package this chip that we're getting fabbed with it, you know, and then they package it together. And now when they install a server, Facebook has a completely custom CPU that has a chip that's dedicated to their deep learning recommendation system model that can access the main pool of memory, right? You're not having separate memory between your accelerator and your CPU. And that's really, you know, a huge, huge use case for CXL.
Well, that's going to be quite an enabler for the hyperscalers to really take over. Like that is a Trojan horse. Night when you put it that way, where it's just like, hey, whatever, you're my customer, just fab in this IP that I already designed. Like it's going to be, yeah, it's going to be pretty interesting. Honestly, I wonder where, I wonder, I mean, if that creates some tension.
Intel might live too, right? Like, yeah, I think you know, they're completely screwed over the next few years, I think, you know, until at least 2024 minimum. But, and, you know, if they can get that, if they can say, hey, please don't leave me for, you know, everything, you know, we can do the packaging for you. We can build the CPU that's, you know, got the basic hook-ins to everything, you know, maybe we can do it, right? You know, maybe they aren't completely screwed out.
Almost like a parasite that fabs for you, I feel like, or it's like, by the way, buy a CPU, like just buy one CPU, please. Just one CPU. We'll fab the rest, you know, but like, it's just like
a beggar on the street. Yeah. CPU
for your wares, please. Like, but I just, oh my God, that's really funny. Actually, I just really wonder, like, cause I feel like that's cat out of the bag. Like think about, you know, 10 years ago where essentially the server or the cloud or the data center was just a ton of CPUs connected to each other. And now 10 years from now, you're like, dude, where is the CPU in this equation? Like it's becoming like, obviously it's going to be a very important workhorse and like, it's very general, like CPUs are awesome, but like it's becoming just one of the other tools. And something I thought was also really interesting is I think the DPU centric version of the future is probably also going to be very enabled by CXL as well. Because right now, DPUs right now are just like air traffic controllers. But in the future, when everything is like truly in network and all the memory is like kind of on network, like I feel like DPU adoption or like the DPU attach rate just has to probably explode with that, right? Like that just seems very logical to me. Instead of it just being like an accelerator to CPU kind of connection as little nodes, but instead we're going to actually be thinking about things from a DPU, CXL, memory coherence on the top level, and that's really going to move DPU usage much higher.
Let me ask you, how do you think that even like hooks in together, right? Like, okay, you have this, you know, server full of a bunch of CPUs in one cabinet and a bunch of memory in one cabinet, a bunch of AI processors in one cabinet, and you can say, hey, customer, you want an instance with this much CPU performance, this much memory, and this much AI performance? Here you go, right? That's maybe what the cloud hyperscaler does, but where does the networking to the rest of the world fit in there, right? Is it, you know, where does that slot in? Obviously, that has to sit somewhere. And it's not going to be on CXL, right? You know, that's, you know, anything, you know, long distance is obviously still going to be based on, you know, yeah, Ethernet protocols. So where does that stuff kind of even sit in somewhere? Like, and how far back do you sit away from that now, right?
I don't know, man. I mean, I like kind of wonder, like, okay, so right now how I think about it is top of rack is the top of rack Ethernet out is like kind of where it stops. And so within the rack is going to be all CXL'd up because 42 slots or whatever for you to do whatever the hell you want. And then like, that's a pretty big node into itself. But like in that world, I guess one of the blades is a DPU just doing distribution between it. But like over the longer run, that doesn't seem to make any sense to me, right? Like, do you think that maybe like the nodes start to connect to each other at like this more pooled level? And then once again, there's like another higher level, like the top of rack moves like another higher level up. Is that like how it works? Cause I know Ethernet is going to end up being the final in and out, but the where the heterogeneousness ends at this giant pool ends and where like, you know, Ethernet starts is going to be really interesting to me. I know where it probably ends and starts in the next 5 years, but maybe in the next like 3-5 years, but like the next 10 years, I really cannot help but wonder like, blow up the CXL protocol even bigger? So.
Yeah. Like, you know, not talk about one single rack, but talk about 10 racks, 20 racks, 50 racks, right? Where does that delineation end? And it might be that like, your CXL switch, which is connecting everything together, also just so happens to have a DPU, right? And the vendors that are building this all have that IP, right? Marvell's DPU, they have CXL, they bought Tanzanite. You know, Intel, they have their DPUs. They're probably going to build a CXL switch. They haven't announced it, but I would bet money.
I mean, CXL was originally
AMD, same thing.
CXL was originally theirs, right? Like it was originally like an Intel-led consortium. So if they don't build something, you're like, what the hell?
Yes. It's a really funny story because the whole industry tried to do it sort of without them on PCIe 4 kind of physical layer. It was called CCIX. Yeah. And then Intel was like, oh shit. We're not going to adopt that, but here's the next generation thing. And everyone's going to adopt this because we have muscle and everybody's like, okay, we'll adopt that. And then CCIX is like dead. So it's like, did Intel delay all of this by like 2 years or more?
Well, what's interesting is like this might be one of the last things where they really shove us a protocol down everyone's throat. And then like they have like no real say in the very long term. Like it really might be like the last death throw of their like, let's say, peak relevance and power in deciding the roadmap. But yeah, that's a really interesting point. But yeah, so Marvell is obviously a contender. I think AMD is going to be a contender. Intel's going to be a contender. There's just going to be a lot
NVIDIA's,
of...
NVIDIA's yeah. just going to do their own protocol, right? They're going to be like... You can do CXL where you want to, but you know, you are the whole server, it's just going to be our shit, right? Like,
well, they're trying to make essentially like NVLink is kind of like a superset of CXL where it's like, oh, it's backward compatible, but like, we don't care about those losers anyways. You're on our stack. Like, don't,
yeah,
you know?
I mean, they're sort of doing the whole like, we're not going to adopt the standard fully. I mean, we'll support it, but you know, the standard moves so much slower than we do. So, haha, we're better,
yeah.
Right?
Yeah.
So, I think that's the whole viewpoint they have.
Yeah, but we're going to see, like, I feel like with the least like standards and the hyperscalers, they've really loved open the entire time. Like, right. Ethernet is an extremely open, like the open, I want to say it's the open interconnect or OCF, OFC. There's some fiber optic consortium that's extremely hyperscaler dominated. So I think it's going to lean open, but we're going to see, because, you know, as much as NVIDIA wants to shove their protocol down everyone's throats, you know, the world where Facebook and Google get to manufacture stuff with with Intel and have like a subservient fab essentially is one where I don't think Nvidia gets to really determine the roadmap. But this is all really interesting stuff for the long run, because this is all years away. But I can't help but be like really excited, because this is like one of the few inflections that I've like where I'm like, oh, this is really happening now. Like, I've been reading, thinking about CXL for years, but it's like actually happening, and it actually seems to have a lot of momentum. And the fact that they're doing it from the bottom level at UCIe all the way up to essentially a data center interconnect fabric is really interesting to me, where it's like, oh, this protocol wins. So.
Yeah, the funny thing is, you had an article about, oh, tech monopolies go vertical like 2 years ago, and that's not going to happen for years, right? And so that's the fun thing, right? Talking about things that are going to happen years out. I've been shilling silicon photonics for like 2 years, 3 years now, but you know that's not going to be a thing for another four. So who cares?
Yeah, it's really hard. It's really hard because like, I feel like the one part that's really interesting about semiconductors as like an investor perspective is that things are very telegraphed. So you can like call inflections very early and sit on them for a long time, and it works out really well. But sometimes you're like, damn, when is this inflection coming? Because I've been waiting. Like silicon photonics particularly, like I'm like, what's to stop us? Come on, guys. Like, it's better. It's just better. But like, I know that mixed signal is extremely hard, and then it will like kind of blow up how all the packaging and integration is done. And so there's just like kind of this intrepidness of like, okay, well, I don't really know if I'm going to do that, because it's going to be going from components plugging into each other to like having to be really calculated with how you package everything. And they're like, sounds really hard, man, maybe next year. So but yeah, do we talk about most of the companies? Obviously Rambus I love, but it's like very random and very specific and super niche. But at the high level, I feel like we talked
about... You're not allowed to pump your shitty companies on this podcast. Sorry, Mule.
Whoa. No.
It's a good company. It's a good company. Sorry.
No. But like, okay. So it's like thematically correct, if that makes sense. Like, does it have the best torque? Like me, like I wish it was a higher quality. Like I truly wish we could find a better pure play, but like, this is what I got, baby. Like, it's like, I would do almost anything to be long, just the Marvell interconnect, or obviously Nvidia's inner, like there's a lot of parts of it, Nvidia. I'd love to be long them, but obviously
just jettison gaming and, you know, give that whatever, you know, multiple you want. I'll buy everything else.
Yeah. I'll buy everything else. Well, I mean, we might get like, that's honestly the hope and opportunity, is that gaming, the channel absolutely implodes like 2018, and then we're like, okay, baby, this is the last stop before data center train really arrives. You know, like, we'll see though. It's definitely a little bit.
I think the big players, you know, have to have all the IP, right? So it is, you know, just to recap, it's like, you know, obviously AMD, Intel, Marvell, Nvidia. Trying to think who else has really got all of the IP.
Once upon a time, you'd say Broadcom, but like, hell no.
No.
Well, that's what's really interesting. Don't they kind of have the most to lose from this? Like, it's going to very much depend the flavor of switches, right? Like, switching will definitely be more tightly integrated with all these like kind of end network rack, you know, CXL switches. And I'm like, Broadcom, where you at, boys? Like, I mean, maybe they'll get purchased as a merchant, whatever. They'll support some stuff, but I feel like they just aren't really pursuing this heterogeneous, like extremely calculated vision of what it means to bring custom silicon to it.
They're just, you know, it's like, we'll double our performance every 2-3 years, right? Which is great. But like, what about when a paradigm shift happens that 10x's it, right? So they don't have any DPUs, right? They canceled their whole entire DPU lineup for whatever reason, but they just don't have DPUs. And it's like,
wait, really?
You guys have the best networking IP. You've had the best networking IP for decades, right? You know, what
they
are
just
you
don't
doing,
reinvest.
Right?
They don't reinvest.
You are companies within you. Yeah, that you've bought up.
Well,
like,
yeah, they don't reinvest. Like, that's the whole model. So actually, there's a perfect analogy is Broadcom is a financial strategy. This is a financial strategy pursued in semiconductors that we've seen multiple times before. The most famous example is TXN, where obviously analog chips, extremely long lives, nothing really needs to change there. The company that tried to do this financial strategy had this huge dominant incumbent business that eventually imploded was Intel. Intel got TXN in MB, where they just bought back 100% of their free cash flow and shares every single year, right? Like that really works when you have a core business that's doing really well, which in this case is the switching business at Broadcom. But when that paradigm shift happens and you're caught flat-footed and you don't invest, that's when all of a sudden your company is not worth as much. And I think, like, you know, it's really hard to call when that happens, but like, the paradigm CXL breaking apart the data center into composable, you know, stuff. If there's ever a paradigm shift for Broadcom to miss, this has to be it, right?
Yeah, one of them. And but then the question is like, but does the peter off that, the slow decay, do they extract enough cash out of it that it doesn't matter? Which, well, I think is probably likely, right?
That's the strategy. That is the strategy. The bet is that they extract enough cash that it doesn't matter. But these, like, Broadcom does still trade at a multiple that implies that it's a, you know, it's a business that continues to grow and is a very large relevant part of the semiconductor industry. But then all of a sudden, when that annuity cash flow is not valued the same like it used to be, that when it gets re-rated, it can be a very painful drop. And so we'll see, but I'm not holding any horses out for that. We'll see. I would love for it to happen because,
yeah, like, changes are always slower than you think, but then when they happen, they're faster than you think.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that's exactly. I mean, like, I feel like every year I'm like, dude, Broadcom's got a misstep. And then, like, you're like, okay, this is going to be it, but it's going to be like 8 years from now. It's like, oh, Broadcom's
broke. I've had an article in my drafts for like 2 years about why Broadcom is going to lose. And it echoes all of this stuff, share losses at RF, share losses at networking. And it's like, yeah, but it's not happened yet.
Yeah, it's not going to happen anytime soon. Yeah. I would love for it to happen soon. It'll be very interesting and more fun to write about. So, I mean, I'm trying to think of, well, honestly, I feel like we covered way more than I expected, but DTCO, backside power delivery, CXL, all this changing stuff, lots of cool technical stuff. There's probably, it's crazy. It's like, I feel like this really has only hit our radars, at least mine, like super hard in the last 6 months. So like 6 months from now, we could be talking about like God knows what. So.
Yeah. And I feel like everyone is just smarter at semiconductors, right? Me and you, we're a lot smarter at it, but so are all of our readers, right?
Yeah.
Like, you can see how much smarter some of our readers are about the semiconductor industry now versus a year ago. It's absurd.
Oh, it's absurd. Yeah. And it's like, I'm keeping ahead, but it's like,
and
bro,
you guys. That's ourselves too, right? Like, I look back at something old and I'm like, I was stupid.
That was factually incorrect. Yeah. There's some stuff I was like, what the hell were you thinking? But yeah, I mean, I'm getting really humbled by the history side of things, doing a history dive. And I'm like, you know, it's like, wow, highest capacity utilization ever. I'm like, this honestly feels a lot like 95. Like, there's a lot of stuff that this is maybe not okay. Every cycle is different. This one didn't, you know, this one has happened before.
This is 1995. So we still got a dot-com bubble ahead of us. Hell yes.
Well, what happened was in 93, there essentially was a shortage and then 2 years of crazy supply additions. And then like DRAM turned and then it's like, oh, it's all over. But also very different. DRAM price collapsed 75% in 1 year. Very different. Yeah. Yeah.
Holy
actually,
crap. Yeah. For those of you who weren't able to see that, my mouth just stayed open for a minute.
Yeah. Just for like a minute. Yeah. Just flew. Well, it's really crazy. Actually, we were talking about this, how DRAM is actually going to be the less cyclical part of this cycle, probably because of how well managed supply and demand is, which is crazy. Like, I just told you that supply overshot demand so much that price had to go down 75% for it to clear. This round, I do not think memory is going to do the crazy implosion that it almost always does. And like, memory is 9 times out of 10 the culprit. This round, not so much. They've done a really, like, the memory oligopoly continues to win. So anyways, I think this is where we're going to leave it. Anything else you want to leave it at?
That's all. Yeah, it was great talking to you again, and hopefully we can get back to more regular podcasts. It's been a few months, but yeah, thanks for joining us on Chip Chat. This is Dylan.
Yeah, this is Doug. Thanks. Please follow us along on our Substacks or Twitter or wherever you find us. We always love to talk about semiconductors, and we'll talk to you next time. Take care.
Peace.